A Book of Light by Rosalie Hirsch, our guest today on Calvos and Damien
in the House.
And we're going to go back to that interview before she was in the house. She didn't know she was going to be in the house.
Right, she was still bizarring.
Yes.
As were we.
And at the table is where we were. And a white table. Very pure, just for us.
Yeah,
and,
but it didn't last long.
No.
I think once we started spilling food.
Yes. And the coffee and the whipped cream and all of those good things. Let's go back to that interview. And then when we take our next break, we'll come back with some electroacoustic music. It's interesting because there's always the problem of how much a listener gains in the process of listening to a piece, so that later in the piece they have a memory that carries forward about the language of the piece.
Yeah.
And I suppose creating a structure ahead of time is one of those ways in which we kind of hope that we can get around this difficulty of learning the new grammar every time we learn a new piece.
Yes.
So you had to kind of, and you kind of had to go the other way and say, well, in reality, most of our experience with music is sort of temporal in the short term.
Yes.
And
yes.
So where does that leave the sort of collective memory of the piece as it is listened to?
The mystery of Louis' music, for example, very often unfolds after having listened to the piece, which I find amazing. It's an amazing experience when you actually have listened to the piece. It works in a perfect way, almost. I mean, he's a genius, according to me. And theoretically, I mean, genius, I don't like that word, but he is, yeah. And so it works in a wonderful way during the piece. But then you get something extra after the piece is finished. And I think that's magic. That's magical. And that actually makes you listen to the pieces again. Because you want to get that magical feeling. Then you grasp the piece.
Yeah.
And it is something else than you expected it to be. That's real beauty, I think.
So if you refocus on the moment to moment, how does a piece survive multiple listenings then? How does that magic get maintained?
For me personally, I always try to do something different than, I always try to choose the other option.
Okay.
And in a way, you have to first find the what would be more normal, and then you alter it. So that's in a way what I do. And I've realized more and more that sometimes it's not necessary to alter the instances of the piece. In as the whole, they would still serve a kind of a function of being different from the rest anyway.
Okay. Yeah.
So I feel, in a way, things can be far more seemingly normal when I do them.
What may be normal for you may be entirely unusual for someone else, and I think that's the beauty of composition by individuals.
Yes, that's true. But there is a certain consensus of what, you know, that tradition is a very mysterious thing also.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe because I started late, I had a different view on tradition for a long time, and I've embraced tradition more and more. I don't think that my music has become more traditional, but I think maybe my wish is to incorporate it more and more. So in a way, tradition doesn't stand apart from me, but I feel actually that it's inside me. I incorporate it, and I think. For people who started young and had maybe a professional education as a musician, violinist or a piano player or conductor, they probably have that more in their veins. This, and it could also be a disadvantage, but I think it's also something desirable as well. So it's interesting what you do with, you know, between those poles, those two poles.
And some
composers, is it too complicated?
No, not at all. Some composers we have met whose names will remain unspoken can't do it. I mean, they just don't do it successfully. They may think they're doing. It's all subjective.
It's not all subjective. I mean, I think one of the interesting things is how we can hear. Especially us, because we don't give music much time to be heard on our show, how in a short time we can get a sense of how compelling a piece will be the first time and multiple times. And I think that's that magic that you were talking about. It doesn't matter how much structure and technique you apply, something beyond that is created by these micro and macro processes.
Yes.
And we often, when we were selecting music to play, we could tell probably within 10 seconds of starting a CD, really, if
through some experience, that is.
If the piece had merit, if the composer had merit.
Yes.
And there were many who did not.
Yeah.
And maybe the composer would have merit for other people, but we're better than them.
By the way, this is Carlos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, or whatever we're going to call it next, on the road. We're sitting on the Zingel in Amsterdam, in case you're wondering what all the noise is. It's the wind. It's a windy day in October of 2005, and lots of people going by, and lots of... I can't even remember the English word anymore, never mind. But lots of little vehicles are passing through. And Rosalie Hirsch is our guest, and we're delighted to be speaking with her because it's been several years that we have been listening to her music. We're going to, from now on in doing the bazaar, we're going to be just talking to people, and then we're going to cut the music in later because we no longer have to do a kind of a real-time presentation. So we'll put the music in later. By now you've already heard a couple of pieces, and we're going to go back to our conversation with Rosalie Hirsch.
Take another break from our interview with Rosalie Hirsch, and we'll listen to something programmed in Max MSP.
Would you explain that?
Max. It's a program originally devised for the Macintosh, and I believe that was the first appearance was there. I don't think it appeared. It's a modular programming language. It's kind of like drag and drop your latest special effect and create new ones. And so instead of having to write code in formulas, you write it as a group of objects connected together by little virtual wires.
Is it available on Windows, or is it strictly Macintosh?
Oh, yes, it's available on Windows. If you have a spare $495, you can pick up your own private copy.
Yes.
Anyway, this is done in that program, and it was played at the Mediated Music Festival.
Oh, fine.
Yes, exactly.
Where is it?
Twente University in the Netherlands in October of 2001. Here it is. Noise, tilde. I don't know how you pronounce it. It's a little tilde after noise. Noise, tilde, by Rosalie Hirsch. Noise,
Tilda.
2001 piece by our guest Rosalie Hirst. You want to hear some violin music?
Violins. I'd like to hear some violin music.
Violins music.
Violent.
This is something, a program that I believe we were both on. I'm not positive. This is the Tote Met series, which is no longer being done. Samuel Friesen had this series in the Netherlands for a while. Do you know that?
I don't.
Oh, okay. Maybe it was just me that had a short piano piece on it. Here we have Anna McMichael, a violin, live at the Concerto Tote Met in the Batanian Cloister, which used to be really like, you know, Drunks and Druggiesville, and got upscale in a few years, and nobody could afford to live there anymore, of course. And so here's a recording of Article 4.
Do we know which article?
Not a clue. A and the, I don't know. Uh-huh. We only have three. I don't know. Article 4, or maybe it's, you know, the Universal Declaration or something. It's lowercase, so I don't really know. Article 4 from 2004 with Anna McMichael, as I said, and Rosalie Hirsch is the composer.
And we are
in the house. Thank you.
Article 4. Did you figure it out yet?
Yeah, it's not quite 5, but it was much more than 3.
A and the...
No, not those articles.
Oh, not those articles.
No, it was the article of the Declaration of Dutch Dependence.
Dutch Dependence?
Dutch Dependence.
Is that like, you know, when you get incontinent?
I don't think we need to go farther than that. All right.
Let's go back to the interview. Oh, yeah, Anna McMichael on the violin. That was from 2004, Rosalie here, so we'll go back and talk to her some more.
You went from studying with Louis. Did you jump immediately to New York after that, or did you have some time experience as a kind of a professional composer after that?
There was 1 year in between.
Okay.
But so it was, in fact, quite soon that I applied to Columbia. It was by chance, really, as seemingly a lot of things happened in my life, that I met somebody at Fontainebleau, the summer course at Fontainebleau, who studied with Tristan Murail, and we spoke about him, and I knew his music already. And this guy said, I think it really would be something you would love to study with. So I applied, and I was extremely nervous.
But again?
I got in. Yes, of course. Always, you know. And that's how I ended up in New York for 3 years.
Three years?
Yeah.
And what was it like, not only what was it like studying with Tristan Murail, but also what was it like in comparison with studying with Louis? What different things did you learn? First, about Tristan, sort of objectively.
Yeah, I learned also, I took more classes in electronic music, and as Tristan is very good in integrating electronic means and instrumental means, and the fusion of those different worlds, that I really got into. And studying more electronic music, I also became aware of how perception comes into play. And that's something I had not learned at the Hague Conservatory. I hadn't studied sonology, for example, which was simply a matter of, I simply didn't have the time. Finishing the whole curriculum in the, you know, usual composition curriculum. I didn't have the time to study sonology. So I think I became acquainted with a lot of those principles what is the psychology of the perception music.
And what did you learn about that? What did you learn about perception? I'm particularly interested in the approach to electroacoustic, electronic music,
yeah,
because you have a perception mechanism turned exclusively toward the sonic source, and there's no visual involved.
Yes, with the difference and the different tones and the some tones. Yes, that's the piece Book of Mirrors I wrote in 2001. That's definitely a piece I couldn't have written back in Holland. I did. I must say though that in 1997, when I was writing Sacro Monte, which is my first say piece with which I was happy, at least half, at least part. And for that piece, I investigated already the addition tones, and somebody from the sonology department wrote a program for me to calculate those. But it was in a way too complicated to translate, and that's why I didn't use it for that piece. But these kind of thoughts I investigated more, and they became the basis for Book of Mirrors. Yeah, and all the harmonies actually are calculated by addition of frequencies, and so really looking at the frequency domain and translating that to pitches for the ensemble, the ensemble of 19 instruments. That was the main thing of that piece. And I would have never done it so rigorously, I think, if I hadn't studied with Murail.
Talk more about the perceptive aspect, though, the perception. Because, you know, when you were talking about the time you were studying with Louis, you were talking about that sort of moving to simplify it, to heavy planning, to being concerned with the real-time moment-to-moment.
Yes.
And yet, working in electroacoustic seems to be just the opposite of that. And it also contained a great difference in perception for the listener.
Yes. I basically was into, and that was my aim also, I wrote it even in my application to Columbia, is to create a coherent sound space where you could actually move as a listener, where you could kind of feel a perspective of the sound space. So to kind of have a more intrinsic relationship between the pitches, and somebody like Vivier does this wonderfully, and James Tenney, whose work I became acquainted with during my studies at Columbia as well, does this in an amazing way, I find. And so, in a way, that you could perceive sound as a kind of space through which you could move. Change of perspective, I think.
Was there a time after you came back? Now, how long has it been?
I came back in 2002, so that's 3 years ago.
So, did you study with Clarence Barlow, or is he just a friend of yours?
I did study in my final year at the Hague Conservatory. I did take composition lessons with him and the music quantics class, which I loved. I adored it.
Tell a little bit about the music quantics, because Clarence Barlow, former guest on Calvus and Damien, is finishing his music quantics book right now. So maybe you could tell a little bit about what that is.
Yeah, it's in a way he introduced me to that, to the whole thinking in the frequency domain, in ratios between frequencies, in how these could work out in a structural way, in a time
domain. For our average listeners, though, what does that mean?
It has to do with what you would call, with the harmonic series, for example, with pure intervals, which in America is called just intonation. I didn't know at the time, I must honestly say, is how I could write in that way. And because I don't see myself writing scores with ratios and with, I just don't see it happen. And so in a way, studying with Murray helped me to find a way how you can actually approximate some of these pure intervals, or maybe even an entire harmonic series, maybe distorting the certain point. And this approximation, you could, when it's played by the musician, they kind of tune to each other. And they also told me, for example, the Schoenberg Ensemble, when it played Bukhara by Vivier, they told me, some of the musicians told me, so it's a very mysterious thing that suddenly you feel which exact intonation you have to play so it will sound
convincing
and sound in tune
and in tune.
So I think also that in a way the system in how Murray notates in microtones. He uses quarter tones, but Prise, for example, uses eighth tones also. I think it's a very valid system to be used. If you maybe also explain in program notes to the musician what is desired. And for example, the Asko and Schoenberg Ensemble have played Grise's Les Espaces Acoustiques in an amazing. They've made an amazing recording of that, and they told me a similar thing. That when you have a harmonic overtone series, that you feel, that the musician feels exactly which pitch they have to play, and that it's, of course, it's slightly different from how it might be notated, but that's something. And you can achieve that also by implementing electronic sounds, which have the absolute frequencies, which correspond with the absolute frequencies.
Control.
Yes. Yeah. And that I also find very interesting in Murray. So in a way, with Clarence, he introduced me to some of those thoughts and those materials, perception and ratios, the idealized harmonic series,
right.
A kind of idealized concept. And in a way, I learned more how to apply it when I studied with Murray. Yeah. But I took the classes with Clarence while I was studying with Louis, because I just liked to have a different view on things. Yeah.
Let's take another break from the interview, and we're going to listen to Dog Making Kit. Now, once again, we have a use of English, which might be a pun. It might be one of those examples of not knowing what the context is, and therefore you don't know whether the verb is sort of transitive or not. Is it dog making a kit, a little dog, a pup, but crossing it with a cat? Or is it a kit to make a dog? There's no hyphen.
No.
Or is it dog making it, but using a little extra glottal?
I'm sure we'll find out when we listen to the tune. I'm sure it'll be self-explanatory.
I'm sure it will be. Here it is. Dog Making Kit, a piece from 2000, electroacoustic. And our guest is Rosalie Hirse. The voice here is of Anne Elliott.
31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, Ewing and his Shevitz, the corny suit was 87. The 42. Beer keg was 43. The 44. Don't walk was 45. The lap 46. Dance was
wrapped in a mystery.
47. 48.
The ice cream was
89. 50.
The dog making kit was
81.
Bungee.
Dog making kit.
Greetings from
canal. that puppy will save us. In dog we trust, pray thee to dog. I look at puppy calendars for mud.
Fall 86.
Dog making kit. Now we know. Everything's clear.
Sure is to me.
Absolutely. Music by Rosalie Hirst. We'll go back to the interview and wrap it up there. And we'll come back for one last piece after the interview. So back to Amsterdam for a last little bit of sunshine and whipped cream.
Different view on things.
Yeah. So, how are you working now? I mean, what are you exploring? What kind of music are you writing, and for whom?
I wrote a piece earlier this year for the Oscar Ensemble.
Yes.
And that piece I dedicated to the memory of Jonathan Kramer, who was a very dear professor of mine at Columbia. I admired him greatly, and amazing personality also, so I dedicated that piece to him. And that piece explores the platonic harmonics, which Plato describes as a kind of a model for the world soul and etc. I'm not a philosopher, so I won't give you the... I read it all, but I can't.
Is it an instrumental piece or an acoustic?
Yes, yes. It was written for six instruments, but it was so difficult to play that I'm now rewriting it for 12 instruments. And in fact, it will also be rewritten for chamber orchestra and be played in March in Prague.
In Prague?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good. Yeah.
Yeah. I just got the email, the confirmation that I hope.
Oh, you just.
Yeah, well, 2 days ago.
And Asko is playing it there, or is it a different ensemble playing it?
No, it's different. Yeah.
What made it so difficult? Did the musicians say that there were just range that was out of the range?
It's basically, that's part of the problem, changing between different instruments, piccolo, flute, clarinet, bass clarinet, but also the strings. They play a lot of consecutive fifths, which is very difficult. So if you have too many of them, you have to use a barre at the top, and then you basically cannot tune the highest notes. And it was all those fifths, I guess, with Plato, you end up with a lot of fifths. It was just, it was too difficult. So I decided to double the amount of players.
Yeah.
So you would, and also the piano, I already reduced this part, was far too much for him to play, so I make cuts on them. And I have two violins, two violas, two celli, and flute and piccolo and clarinet, bass clarinet. So they actually can take. They're not constantly playing, so they can actually take the figures and they are dovetailed. Yeah.
Did you discuss the instrumentation with any of the instrumentalists while you were writing, or how did you get your familiarity with the instruments for which you write?
These instruments are, of course, new already, and I do take risks. And in this case, it was quite... They didn't have so much time to rehearse, so it was all... I think it was problematic in the end that it turned out beautifully in the Concertgebouw. So the people were very happy in the audience, and with the musicians, I decided we recorded it, I decided it would be better if I make another version for 12 instruments.
Does that also give you more opportunity for color, or is it simply to be easier on the players?
It will result. The first reason is that it's easier on the. It's better to play, but also it will result in a more, rich sound because they don't have to, they're not struggling, but it will actually be easy for them to play. And they're the last and the first section, which you actually haven't heard because you only have the middle section. I send you an excerpt. They're slightly minimal nature, and it kind of longs for this bigger instrumentation. So it will be more resonant. It will resonate more. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you said sort of minimal in nature. Do you mean minimal in the kind of American pulse minimalist sense, or do you?
The last section, yes.
Uh huh.
Yes.
Uh
huh. Yes. The first section maybe in a more Louis sense.
I see.
Yeah.
So what's the attraction to that?
Yeah.
Especially coming from a couple of years of study in the spectral realm.
It is. It's funny. In case of me, it really seems that these two sides are kind of like each other. So I have this kind of exploration of sound and timbre, and then I do like this kind of drive and in this piece it's really a juxtaposition of these different sections, and one has more this nature and the other one has more that, and still it's all the same harmonic world,
mm-hmm.
or timbral world, as you will. But it just has happened in two pieces of mine. A Book of Light is another piece where this has happened, and I kind of like it as it maybe it's kind of dialectic within a piece. I like.
Tell a little about your listeners, people who hear your music, and their what you learn about their experience with it.
I like very much to speak to listeners, and you have the listeners who don't know contemporary music very well, and they say, "Oh, it's so spooky." And of course, those listeners, I can't learn much from. But the other listeners, the people who I respect very much musically, the composers I'm friends with, and whose work I adore, of course, if they comment on stuff, I love it, and I love discussing music, and I'm very much a person of the real experience. I like to discuss experiences. Rather, I'm not so good with names and all this knowledge. Of course, I know the basics, some of the basics, but in general, I really like to discuss experience. Yeah.
This seems to be different from a generation or two ago in the composition, where the focus seemed to have been on the creation of the piece and not a concern with how it's externalized.
Yes, I think now the process of creation is really a means of achieving a certain perceptual thing, and I think we are more and more aware of perceptual and neurological processes, and it's in a way they're used as metaphors still. I think also Tristan Murail, I think he uses a lot of these perceptual processes as metaphors, but they do work in a perceptual way, which is very interesting. So, I mean, you can't say that we're more scientific and we know what we're doing, but we really use these things as sources of inspiration, and they do work. And Griset, for example, who said, okay, we can really use the frequency analysis of sound, and we can use it for our composition, and it can mean all kinds of structural things, can mean a lot of things, how time passes and how things are perceived on a small level and a large level. And I find that very interesting, and that's definitely a different approach.
Tell us, if you will. By the way, our guest is Rosalie Huse, and we're sitting here on a windy day on a single in Amsterdam, and sunny but windy, and after some wonderful sweets.
Who cares?
Don't. Oh, you don't care about the sweets.
I want more.
Oh, you're rubbing the sugar into your hand. I see. And you have brought up a name of a composer who has come up in the discussions of composers of so many different styles who claim this one to be kind of an antecedent, and that's Claude Vivier. Tell how you perceive the contributions of Claude Vivier, who has actually died quite young.
Yes, sadly, very, very young. I love his stuff. I adore it,
mm-hmm.
So it's very irrational. I maybe have good reasons, kind of after having analyzed his pieces, but For me, these pieces, who might use geographical names of places which exist, are actually almost exemplary for his internal geography. He's kind of exploring his experience, his perception. He creates, he is very successful in creating coherent sound spaces, and it's very sensual music, which I really like, and it's very creative. Bukhara, for example, uses a language which doesn't exist, which he wrote, which I love. It uses these addition tones, which I mentioned before. And for me, it's so extremely personal music. It was really, I feel, it was really what he wanted to write. Unfortunately, he wrote only about 10 of those pieces before he died. But I feel it's, because it's so entirely personal, it's become very valid from a kind of experience point of view, and some people think it's it's kind of exotic, there's exoticism,
exotic, yes, yeah.
And they kind of don't like that aspect of it, but I think he uses that exoticism for it kind of shows that we cannot know ourselves, that and that, but he investigates it, and I find it very very consistent. His pieces are very consistent also. Sipangu as well, and I like it very much.
Several times you mentioned, both in regard to VVA and your own work, the concept of a coherent sound space. What is that?
Yeah, it's difficult to... I use it as a metaphor, of course, because what we have is time and frequency, pitch. In music, if those would be the parameters, of course, we have rhythm, but then that's part of time. And I feel with VVA and with Grise as well, and with Murai as well, to a certain extent, is that, and Tenny as well, especially, I just was listening to pieces I adore of Tenny, Song and Dance for Harry Parch. And I first will answer your question before I will go on to another topic. But the song definitely is also a sound space, and I feel that the coherence between what the instruments do, or say the relationship between what the instruments do, and that you can grasp a certain, that almost the harmonies fuse into a timbre, say, and still you have a kind of feel of harmonic movement, that's a very interesting thing to me. And I think that has to do with sound space. So that you have a drive forward, so there's not a stasis, and also you feel that the things belong together, what the instruments do. And, and the so-called spectralist composers, the French school, which is essentially an aesthetic school, in fact, do this as well. Are maybe more, stylistically, do it in a stylistic, in a particular, on a particular street or road. And I'm kind of looking, interested in it in a much broader sense.
Okay.
In the same way as maybe Tenny.
Yeah, you're going to branch back to Tenny.
Yes.
I heard it coming.
If that's okay.
No, of course.
Yeah.
James Tenny, by the way, former guest on Calvo Santamian. You can look into the archives to hear our interview with him, which was done in 1997, so it's quite a few years ago now.
In his song, from the piece Song and Dance for Harry Parch, he does something which is in fact quite similar to what spectralists could do. He analyzes a voice, the voice of Harry Parch, and he puts the the fundamental we just has analyzed. He actually puts it in the adapted viola, the one of the instruments Parge invented. And what he does, which I find amazing, is that he puts the formants of the voice, which are the kind of frequencies characteristic to a particular voice.
Distinguishing characteristics of
the
voice.
He puts them to the closest harmonic. In the for example, the strings and then the consonants he puts with percussion. He kind of has little attacks in the percussion instruments. And what you get is a very... You do hear somebody speak. It's a phrasing like Vivier does in Bukhara. And it has a lot of similarities to that piece, strangely enough, although because it was made in a very different way, namely by analyzing an existent voice. And amazing. I find it a very, very beautiful piece. The piece I love of his as well is Diapason. I don't know how Diapason.
Diapason is how we say it in English.
Yeah. Sorry. I never speak with people so much about these titles, so they kind of lead an own life in my head. So, yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Speaking of your own music again, at an earlier lunch today that we had, you were talking about some influences possibly with the universe or with astrology. Has that entered into... I mean, you were very definite about certain life cycles, and I wonder if that's entered into your composition.
Yes. In a way, Book of Mirrors. The original title was Book of Quasar, Book of Mirrors, Quasar semicolon or colon Book of Mirrors. I left the Quasar out. I thought I'm going to do that another time, writing about Quasar, because it has these pulses piece. And in fact, my new string quartet, which I'm just starting now, will be in a program with Radulescu's fifth string quartet, When the Universe Was Born.
Horacio Radulescu?
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
We're great fans of his.
He is fantastic. And so I think that piece will already be influenced by certain, universe metaphors.
Yeah.
Right? And the Ives Ensemble also has asked me to write a piece next year for, 2007, it's later, based on astrology and astronomy. Or astronomy, I can choose. I don't know yet how it will reflect, but of course it will have to do with partials and ratios of how do you call the time the planet needs to
the zodiac,
the time it needs. So a year for the Earth. What is it called again?
Revolution.
In English?
Revolution.
Mm-hmm. The revolution time.
Yeah,
exactly.
The rotation time is the planet itself, and the revolution is around.
So and the ratios between these planets. In fact, what Clarence also has spoken about is the Saturnal. He actually has used the rings of Saturn for as a kind of example of harmonic. I can't remember exactly, but
he won't be listening. No worries.
Well, I will ask him. I will ask him next week when I see him about this the circles of Saturn, how that works. So. That's also a kind of cosmologically influenced idea. Yeah. So I don't know yet how it will work out, but I will use these kind of things as a metaphor.
Our guest is Rosalie Heers, here in Amsterdam. For the first of our Calvos and Damians, on the road, out of time, out of sync, out of mind.
Out of money.
Out of money, of course, always the same thing.
That's one of the reasons that Calvos and Damians is on the road. We're busking.
We're busking with our microphone. So, shall we cover anything else, or have we sort of done a good portrait of you here today?
Do you want to ask a question of us?
No one wants to do that. It's too dangerous.
It is very dangerous, I must admit. And maybe I could speak briefly about Article 4.
Sure, go ahead.
Which, that's a piece I wrote for solo violin. And it was last Saturday, it was performed by Elisabeth Smalt on solo viola at the Microfest in England, UK Microfest 1. And I just wanted to talk about it because the subtitle is Map Butterfly, and it's about the winging of a butterfly. So the bow is kind of like has the movement of wings. And
what's the subtitle again?
Map butterfly. It's a butterfly with a map drawn on its wings. It's a type of butterfly. It's called, in French, it's called la carte géographique. And in Dutch, it's called landkaartje.
I don't know if we have those in North America.
And in Germany, landkaartje.
Huh?
Yeah. So, and what I do is I, in a way, wanted to investigate how flageolets, harmonics,
yes,
how they relate to the place where they're found on the string. So, what I did is I wrote a piece almost entirely based on natural harmonics, also some artificial, of course, but almost entirely on natural. Then I wrote as a baseline, I kept the kind of course I wrote the fingering, the kind of suggested fingering, and then I, in my mind, I kind of had the bottom line, which of course is never pressed down completely, but just half, so you get the harmonic. But I used the imaginary baseline if you would have pressed down the string to the full. And also the four strings on which it was played. So I kind of have a three-part, not really three-part harmony, but I kind of have a harmony. I have a bass line, I have a melody, and have, in a way I also have the strings as kind of resonances, the fundamentals of the strings as a kind of a resonance in the... I will also synthesize those as in a kind of electronic part, kind of sound space in which the piece can be performed.
Okay.
So, but I will eventually do that. It also works as a solo piece. But what really struck me is that because I thought of this thing also as a baseline, it definitely changed how I made the piece. It definitely changed the harmonics I used, and in a way I feel that I investigated the relationship of those two. So those those notes which would have been pressed down, they're kind of present in the harmonic movement. And by the way, I use those harmonies also in part as the basis of Platonic ID.
So, now, this baseline, is it entirely imaginary in the sense that you know that it's there, but it's not heard, or is it reconstructed acoustically somehow by the performance?
Yes, it is, because sometimes I let the string player play the full finger version. So you actually hear in the last section, for example, with the drive, you sometimes hear actually it's played sul ponticello, so it mixes very well.
Okay.
The timbre mixes
with
very well, but
mix.
You actually do hear where it comes from.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Are you also familiar with the metaphor of the butterfly wing? If it beats in one part of the world.
Of course.
And I want then
the quantum the quantum knowledge.
Right.
That kind
and
of
I wonder
the,
if that
yeah.
enters somehow into your piece, that some beating of the instrument at the very beginning affects something at the very end of the piece, or maybe you can't say it just happens.
It's a very beautiful metaphor, but it hasn't occurred to me when I was writing it.
You may use it now.
Yeah, yeah. It's wonderful.
You may put it in your program and claim that that's how you did it.
Well, thank you. It's wonderful.
So, Rosalie Hirst, thanks so much for joining us on Calvus and Damien's first On the Road, posthumous On the Road. We also had a contribution from Sarah Hatfield, who helped us with our distinguishing between revolution and rotation.
And Che Guevara's rotation versus revolution.
Exactly. Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, let's see what's happening. We will tell you what's coming up, and then we'll play the last piece by Rosalie Hirst. We're not quite sure who our next guest is. It might be Alex Ukpik. Not positive yet. Depends on whether we get together for an interview. It might be Lisa Whistlecroft. Not sure about that yet either. One of the good things about this particular appearance of Calvus and Damien here
in the house
is that we have the opportunity to schedule at our leisure. Time means nothing.
It means something. It means it's passing by without without income or
that's
performances.
True, but you see, the time is passing in a kind of
vacuum.
In a kind of philosophical sense, because we're really going back in time, or perhaps she's coming forward in time, or perhaps everybody has stopped listening, so time has stopped.
Do we have any more from the K&D vault that we can pull out?
Oh, yes. We have Ricardo D'Alfara, a very long interview that we conducted in Montreal a couple of years ago. He's an electroacoustic composer who was in residence at an institute up there with a lot of money in order to create a history of electroacoustic music in Latin America. So it was a very revealing interview because he was in charge of kind of looking to hunt down every single piece of electroacoustics he could find in the history of Latin American music. So it's a real, he is manic during the interview, which is quite wonderful because he's got things to do and I have interrupted him. He's also working at this, I think it's a Langlois Foundation in Montreal. And as you walk in, there's fingerprint sensors and your badges you have to wear and things you have to do to get into the doors. And when you get in there, on the left side is a stack of radios.
Oh.
Can you imagine?
No.
Imaginary landscape. The original Cage radios are sitting there in the foundation.
Ooh.
They have collected all of these objects that were used over the years and then are now handily stored in inaccessible rooms in Montreal. A perfect museum, one you can't get to. Anyway, Ricardo D'Alfara, we'll talk to him in the next few weeks through the magic of this time we were talking about. So let's get back to our last piece by Rosalie Hirsch, unless there's something else we need to say.
No, unless you know what it is.
I do. It's called The Sea.
C major, C minor?
You just see, here it is again. The sea as in the ocean, as in
sea change.
Sea change, yes, but that could be in sea.
Mm-hmm.
But no, three letters, S-E-A. Wasn't it a Khalil Gibran poem or something called The Sea? I hope it's not that. Anyway, it's
Rosalie. It's La Mer-like.
Right, very, very La Mer-like.
Mm-hmm.
This is Rosalie Hirsch with her own voice and the text, and this is done at the CMC in New York in 1999. So we'll see you next time in whatever time that is, whatever it might be.
In
the house.
You.